mostly talk about a new model of computation, of computing with non-interacting particles. So what's special about this model is that it's apparently a very weak model of quantum computing, and that the main way it's weak is that we limit what type of entanglement, what type of interaction we allow our particles. That basically, all that these particles are allowed to do to talk to each other is simply this type of talking to each other that happens naturally solely from being identical. And I'll explain more on that later. And this is likely not a universal mode of quantum computation. You probably can't get all of BQP. You probably can't even get all of classical computation for that matter. So as always, given that, you know, I'm talking about a new model, the onus is on me to explain, why do we care about this model? Why is it relevant? Why is it the right way to think? And there's a few reasons. The main one is that because this is such a limited model, we can get quantum gains with less. In particular, what I'll show is that with non-interacting particles, you can already get quantum effects. You can already do stuff that you couldn't do in the classical world. And that by virtue of this being a restricted model, from an engineering sense, that it seems that it would be easier to build a quantum computer that can solely do this, okay? That, you know, while a universal quantum computer might be 30 years away, perhaps, you know, this is 5 years away. And that besides the practical application, there's also kind of a useful thing about this conceptually. That with quantum computers, we want to kind of understand why can quantum computers do more than classical computers. And by limiting what a quantum computer can do, we probe this difference much more precisely. Okay? So in order to emphasize how much of this is, you know, only a tiny step up above classical, before defining this model, what I'm first going to do is talk about the classical analog. That really, this is basically something you could do classically, except we add a bit of quantum spice at the end. And it turns out that little bit of quantum spice suffices to give you a lot of power. So here's the classical model. I'll explain it in terms of, you know, balls and slots. So you might have seen in science museums these things called Galton's board, these things that look like pachinko machines, where you put in a ball at the top, the ball bounces around randomly and eventually goes into some slot. And if you put in a whole bunch of these balls at once, then in the end you get something that looks, you know, a lot like a bell curve. So we have a similar thing, except instead of one place to put a ball, we have multiple. So if we put a ball in the first of these three input slots, then, you know, it bounces around on the inside, we don't see what happens, but we know that it comes out somewhere, and it comes out in this output slot. Now, this is a random process. If we put it in the same place, it might come out of a different place next time. And we could, you know, rather than putting one ball at a time, put in a whole bunch of balls, and then we observe that they come out in some number of slots, okay? And we'll also hypothesize that these are non-interacting. In other words, that there's nothing special going on between pairs of balls. That if instead you were to have put in one ball at a time, then you'd get the same type of behavior that if you put them all at once. So, questions so far? Okay, so let's, you know, formalize it a bit. Well, we can represent the probabilities of the ball going from each slot to each slot. So say if we put in the ball in the first slot, given that, you know, there's three places that it could come out, and we say that the probabilities of them, we have three respective probabilities, A, B, and C, which, being probabilities, are therefore non-negative numbers that add up to one. And the same likewise for every column. So this transition matrix for a single ball is simply a stochastic matrix. But now let's look at what if instead of simply putting in one ball at a time, we put in three balls at once. What, for example, is going to be the probability that all three balls come out in three different output slots, as opposed to, say, all three coming out in the first slot, or two coming out in the first slot and one in the third slot? So note that the balls are identical. We can't tell them apart. We can't match, say, this ball to which specific one it was in the input. But we can look for every single matching. For instance, we can say, okay, imagine that the first ball came out in the first slot, the second ball in the second slot, and the third ball in the third slot. The respective probabilities of those events are A, E, and I. Now, we furthermore, we hypothesize that this is these are non-interacting balls, that the events of them coming out in each slot are all independent. So the probability of all three of these things happening is simply going to be the product of those three respective probabilities. It's going to be A, E, I. Does it make sense how that, you know, has to follow by virtue of the balls being non-interacting, of them being independent? Okay. But this was just one way that the process could have happened. It could have been, say, that the second and third ball switch places in the machine, and so on. For each of the six possible permutations, the six possible matchings of balls going in and balls going out, we have the respective probabilities. And since each of the ways that this could have happened course contributes to this event of getting one ball in each slot in the output, the final probability is going to be equal to their sum. So this sum over permutations of the products of the corresponding matrix entries might be familiar. It's known as the permanent of this matrix M. So to write it out more generally, the probability of going from one per slot to one per slot, and to introduce a term, I'll call these configurations. A configuration is some, you know, count of there's this many balls in the first slot, this many balls in the second slot, and so on. The probability of this transition between configurations is simply going to be the sum over all permutation of the product of the probabilities corresponding to each of these transitions. And this is known as the permanent of this matrix M. This is very similar to the determinant of the matrix. The determinant also, you know, through Laplace expansion has this form, except the determinant has minus signs. Depending on the sign of the permutation, you subtract or add it, whereas the permanent is all you're solely adding them. Okay. So we've computed the probability of a single transition, the one per slot to one per slot transition. What about other transitions? So, for example, say we put in a ball in the first slot and the third slot, okay? What's the probability then that when we look at what comes out, we have one ball in the first slot and one ball in the second slot?
Permanent A, G, B, H?
Yep, exactly. So, you know, there's two ways it could happen. They correspond to the sum A, G and the sum B, H. So we simply take the permanent of the submatrix. Another way of thinking about it is, okay, you know, we have we're looking at the first input slot, we're looking at the third input slot. Nothing's happening in the third, in the second input slot. We can completely ignore it. We can just take the submatrix that corresponds to the transitions at hand, and it's this matrix, and then this is simply the one per slot event to one per slot event limited to this submatrix. And we can do this for all configurations. What if we have a repetition, right? If instead we put in two balls in the first slot and one in the third slot, and we want to know the probability of that output, we do the same thing. We take the submatrix, except that because here the first column appears twice, right? Therefore, we should take that column and take it twice as well as likewise for the second row, and then compute a permanent for this submatrix. Now you might be wondering why this one half appears. This one half, you need it when there's repetitions as a combinatorial correction factor, because there's a bit of overcounting that goes on. We might look at the probability that one, this ball, for instance, goes to this one and this ball goes to this one, right? And they could be switched, but you can't really tell them apart. We're really counting the same event twice, okay? But modulo this combinatorial correction, the pattern is still the same. In order to find the probability of every transition, we just take the permanent of the submatrix, where the exact way that you take the submatrix is simply given by the counts of rows and columns of the number of balls there. Make sense? Any questions? So here's something we can do. Say we want to write down the entire big transition matrix. Here's what I mean by that. So we can think of this transition matrix that I've written down as simply the transition matrix for one ball states, one ball configurations. What happens now if we consider the transition matrix between multiple ball configurations? Now note that each configuration here is going to be a count of how many balls are in each slot, okay? So we have one configuration corresponding to two balls in the first slot, two balls in the second slot, and so on. And likewise for output configurations. And now we have a whole big transition matrix that each of whose entries gives the corresponding transition probability between the input configuration taken as a whole and the output configuration taken as a whole. So in this example, I've written it out for three slots and two balls. We could just as well as keep increasing the number of balls. And note that as m and n gets bigger, in general, this matrix is going to be exponentially large because the number of ways to assign balls to slots, the number of partitions of n balls into m slots, it grows as an exponential function of m and n, okay? But note that this entire exponentially large matrix is simply determined from the smaller matrix. Because of this hypothesis that the balls are non-interacting, the probability of any transition between configurations is uniquely governed by these variables, these transitions for a single ball that we get simply by computing permanence, like I described on the slide before. Okay? So that was the classical model. I'm going to move on to the quantum model, but like first let me give a summary of what the relevant characteristics are. So we have some number of identical balls and some number of slots. We choose some starting configuration of how many balls are in each slot. We choose some stochastic matrix to apply as the transition matrix. We take each ball and we individually move it per that transition matrix. And at the end, we have some number of balls are now ending up at each slot. That's the resulting configuration. So this at heart is going to be the same model that we use for non-interacting particles in the quantum regime. I'll pause again for questions. Okay, so the quantum model here is going to simply be the natural extension of the classical model that I've just described, but with quantum particles, which can be in superposition. Now, as for particles, there's a decision we have to make, because there's two types of particles that will behave differently for this. Depending on whether bosons or fermions are the particles, you're going to get a different behavior. And let me say specifically what that difference is. So first, you know, for identical bosons, just to reiterate what the model is, we have some boson that goes in into some slot. Now, I've been, you know, visually thinking about these as being balls and slots and boxes, but more generally, these slots we can think of as modes, which, you know, can be spatial modes, or you can just be any characteristic of the particle that can be distinguished perfectly. And this box now is just some random process, some physical process that we apply that takes these modes and transitions them to some other modes. So before, classically, this was a stochastic matrix, but in the quantum world, you know, to preserve unitarity, this, of course, has to be a unitary matrix. And just as before, we could put in a whole bunch of particles and figure out what the probability is of getting as output some other specific configuration of particles. So here again, I want to know what's the probability that if you put in one ball in every, sorry, one particle in every mode, that you still find in the output that there's one particle in every mode. So we get the exact same computation before, except crucially, this is now happening in superposition, right? Before, whereas we didn't know which ball input ball corresponding to which output ball, but that was a matter of our ignorance, now, in fact, we have a quantum superposition over possibilities. It's not possible, even in theory, to match each input ball to each output ball. Therefore, the correct thing to do for the superposition is to add the corresponding amplitudes. And just as before, the amplitude of any single transition is going to be the amplitude of the transitions that correspond to each ball transitioning, each particle in a given mode transitioning to an output particle in a given mode. So just as before, this amplitude was the permanent of this matrix, except now with the difference being that in order to compute the final probability, we need to take the norm squared of this permanent. So note that this is really similar to the classical case. The only difference that we've had so far is that we need to take this norm squared at the end to get this probability. And well, the other crucial difference is that before we had a stochastic matrix, which meant non-negative real entries, now we have a unitary matrix, which means that we're allowed to have complex entries. And this may seem like a small difference, but it actually makes an enormous change in the difficulty of this problem. And the same way we can discuss what is this probability for fermions. For fermions, we have the exact same thing. But fermions have the behavior that anytime you swap two identical fermions, a minus sign comes out. Therefore, for these respective amplitudes corresponding to these different matchings, three of them, the AFH, BDI, and CFG, are going to have minus signs relative to the other ones because you can get them from the other ones by swapping two fermions. So in general, for every swap that happened, we get an extra minus sign phase. So what we get for fermions is instead the determinant of this matrix M. And the probability, analogous to for bosons, is simply going to be the norm squared of this amplitude. Okay? So I've defined this. So far, just as before, I could tell you what is the probability of any transition, computing it just like we did classically by looking at submatrices and permanents and determinants of those. But there's a much nicer formalism of thinking about this, the algebraic formalism, which I'll explain now. And here, we simply represent modes by single particle basis states. So I'll call these the formal variables x1 through xn. Physically, by the way, these are simply creation operators in those modes, if you're familiar with those. And these configurations, these multi-particle basis states, are simply going to be monomials, okay? So if we want to have n1 particles in the first mode, n2 particles in the second mode, and so on up to xm particles in the mth mode, we simply multiply the corresponding monomials. We, you know, multiply in one variable for each one particle that exists. And also we have this kind of annoying scaling factor that just comes from combinatorics to avoid overcounting. It's necessary to make everything normalize nicely. Does this way of writing it make sense? Okay. Now, here is where the difference comes in between bosons and fermions. Identical bosons commute. So for bosons, these polynomials are simply polynomials the way that we're used to writing them, where you can freely swap around every variable. For fermions, on the other hand, for identical fermions, whenever we switch two of them, a minus sign comes out. So these are now instead formal polynomials, formal expressions in these formal variables x1 through xn. Actually, let me emphasize this point. In both of these cases, these x1 through xm are simply formal variables, okay? We're never going to be plugging in numerical values for them. This is simply going to be a generating function. Each of these terms is simply going to correspond to a single possibility, a single configuration. And notice that for these fermions, if you plug in xi equals xj, we're going to get that xi squared equals negative xi squared. And therefore, the square of any formal variable is going to be 0. And what this tells us is simply you cannot have two identical fermions in the same mode. So this is the Pauli exclusion principle just naturally coming out from the anti-commutativity relationship of the fermions. So let me work through an example here of the, you know, kind of the simplest possible example. Let's look at where this unitary is a Hadamard matrix, and I'm going to have two bosons in two slots, putting them in different slots. And I want to know what are the probabilities of the respective outcomes here. So we can write this input state as x, y. I'm going to use x and y rather than x1 and y1, okay? Now we simply apply this matrix, this Hadamard matrix, to each of these two particles individually, right? These are non-interacting particles. So this you can think of this matrix as simply doing a change of basis. So this first particle is going into this plus state, and this second particle is going into this minus state, okay? So far, this is familiar. This is just, you know, what would happen if you were to, in the regular quantum circuit formalism, to apply Hadamard tensor, Hadamard to two particles. Where the magic comes in is in a cancellation, right? We know that identical bosons commute. So we're going to get this xy over 2 and this y, this negative xy over 2 and this yx over 2 term. So when we expand this out as a polynomial, those things cancel. And as a result, we're only left with two terms. I bracketed them this weird way because as per the normalization, this is the normalized term of there are two particles in the slot y, and the normalized term for there are two particles in slot x. So what we've observed is that we have an equal superposition over two possible events, of either having two particles both in the first slot with probability 1/2 and two particles in the second slot with probability 1/2. Note that the events where one particle comes out in each slot was canceled by the fact that the xy and the negative yx term canceled each other out. So this bears some emphasis because this is where the magic is happening. The fact that we can switch x, y, and y, x is representing the fact that these particles are identical, right? This is in contrast with the fact that, in the regular circuit formalism, in the qubit formalism, these two states are not equal, right? It's different to have one qubit in mode 0 and another qubit in mode 1. Versus the first qubit in mode 1 and the second qubit in mode 0. The tensor product does not commute. If we were instead, you know, taking the tensor product of these, the two possibilities would not cancel. But because these particles are identical, we're able to have this this cancellation. Now, exactly how to refer to these as being non-interacting is a contentious issue, okay? And it's a subtle one. Note that on one hand, this was entirely a linear operation, an operation that happened individually to every particle. The x particle went to this state, the y particle went to this state. Never did anything happen that interacted the particles, that coupled the particles. However, by virtue of them being identical, we were able to get this cancellation of xy and negative yx. And by virtue of this cancellation, we were able to get this outcome that is classically correlated. Somehow, purely by the fact of the particles being identical and satisfying these commutation relations, we were able to get correlated outcomes despite never explicitly coupling the particles. I'll pause for questions here. This is an important point, so I want to make sure that I've gotten it across well. You mean physically, why is this happening? One way to say it is physically, this is just a property of identical particles. That by their very nature, identical particles cannot be separable in the usual quantum computing sense. That any state of them has to, in some sense, be symmetric over the particles, which prevents you from factoring over the particles.
Bosons have a tendency to kind of group together. which is basically a statistical property, but that's what you're seeing here, right? They're grouping.
Yeah.
Right. And in terms of, you know, physics, this is interesting and kind of advantageous, because for photons, right, photons don't have charge, photons don't have mass, photons don't tend to interact with each other at typical energy scales. So therefore, it might be surprising that you can do any sort of interesting computation with photons. But we see the fact that them being identical, merely that is already enough to get interesting behavior. And that is what we're going to exploit here. Okay. Let me explain. Oh yeah. By the way, this phenomenon, this specific case with the Hadamard matrix and the two having zero probability of them being in different slots is a well-known phenomenon known as the Hongo-Mandel dip. And this has been verified experimentally that, you know, for photons, that if you put in two photons into a semi-silvered mirror representing this Hadamard matrix, they'll either all both go one way and both go another way. They'll never split. So we can do the same thing for fermions. And note that for fermions, the action of this matrix is the exact same thing. Note, however, that a different thing happens when we expand out and use the anti-commutation relations rather than the commutation relations. So these two states, x squared and y squared, must equal 0 because the square of every formal variable is 0. You can't have two fermions in the same mode. And furthermore, this negative xy is the same as a yx, or said other way, this yx is the same as a negative xy. So that these two cross terms, rather than canceling as they did for bosons, instead have flipped signs and therefore combine. And what we get at the end is the negative xy. So up to global phases, which are irrelevant, this was the same as the input state. So if we do this with fermions, we always get a one particle per mode. Note that, you know, we could have actually predicted this solely from the Pauli exclusion principle, given that we can't have two fermions in the same mode. If we do this experiment with as many fermions as we have modes, no matter what matrix you apply, we're going to have to get one fermion per mode, whereas there's no other possibility. Fermions repel each other. Bosons, in contrast, tend to attract each other, as you saw in the previous example, where they always went into the same mode. Though for while in this example, this always happened, more generally, the boson behavior of clumping is a statistical one. Whereas fermion repulsion is exact. You never get two fermions in the same mode. So let me now talk about this problem as a computational problem, right? I've described what it is as a physical process, but I think it's important to isolate, you know, I'm going to talk about the computational complexity of this problem, exactly what it means to solve it. So we can think of these problems, which I'll call boson sampling and fermion sampling, as kind of black box problems, right? We have this input. The input is this matrix M in this initial configuration that specifies how many particles are in each mode. And the output is going to be the final configuration. And now this is a randomized process, right? Each time you run it with a given input configuration, you might get a different output configuration. Let me emphasize the black box nature of it, right? While I explained these in terms of being physical processes that actual bosons and fermions do, as computational problems, this is purely the mathematical question of given this input, give this output, give this randomized output, okay? So because it's a black box problem, when I talk about this on simulation, the simulation solely needs to match this black box behavior. So a simulation would need to, on the same inputs, generate particle counts with the same probabilities. So this simulation is also some randomized process that when you specify the inputs and you press a button, you get an output. And we want it to have the same probabilities as the physical experiment, okay? But note that these probabilities we could have expressed as purely mathematical formulas in terms of permanence and determinants, without any reference to bosons and fermions at all. As a computational problem, we might imagine that this might be simulated by by some computational process that is completely different, that does not think about particles, for example, just some complicated mathematical way to get outcomes whose probabilities are given by determinants and permanents in this specific way. Okay? And in this frame, in this way of thinking, it's now, there's a very natural question of, can we do this classically, right? I've now explained this quantum process. Is there a way to do it without using quantum particles, okay? Is there a way to do it efficiently without using quantum particles? And that's the central question that I'm going to address now. Let me pause again for questions. So we want to know, how hard is it to simulate these sampling processes?
By doing it classically, do you mean having those stochastic matrix that produce the same?
No, I mean doing any process. Just doing any algorithm that gives the same probability distribution of outputs based on inputs. Mm-hmm. So, yes, so we've looked at three different flavors of this problem, right? The one with classical particles, the one with bosons, and the one with fermions. And I'm going to talk about the complexity of each of them. Let me start with fermions. So with fermions, the function that governs probabilities is the determinant, okay? And we need to take determinants of matrices whose entries come from unitary matrices. Now, in order to compute the probability of a single outcome, we know that this is easy. So we know that there exists a polynomial time algorithm to do it. However, that's not the question we're interested in, right? Our computational question isn't, given this input and this output, what is the probability that this input goes to this output? No, our probability is given this input randomly to sample the distribution. And note, by the way, from there, it's not clear how to do it even if you can compute probabilities. Let me emphasize that this is a quite different problem. Now, you might say, okay, well, it's easy, right? You just compute the probability of every single outcome. These are a bunch of numbers that sum up to one. And then, you know, we just do a weighted random process that gives each of those outcomes with that corresponding numerical probability. That does not work. Can anyone tell me why that does not work?
Exponentially long list.
Exactly. There's exponentially many outcomes. So simply that naive process of computing every probability isn't going to work. Nevertheless, it is known that there is an algorithm to sample from the fermion case. And this is a famous result of Valiant. Actually, sorry, let me take a second to say what the complexity classes are. So a P is the, you know, what you can easily do classically, what you can do classically in polynomial time. A BPP is what you can do classically in polynomial time randomly. The sampling is going to have to be in BPP rather than P because, you know, it's a randomized process. So it's going to take some randomness. So in both these cases, fermions are easy. What about classical particles, right? For the classical balls, we need to take permanents now. And we need to do them of a stochastic matrix. Is that going to be a computationally hard problem? So this is definitely a non-obvious one. And there's a result of Jerome Sinclair Vigoda in 2001 that you can, in fact, approximate the probabilities of outcomes in the classical case. So the fact that if you want to take the permanent of a non-negative matrix, then you can, in fact, compute it to within some small error. And furthermore, you can sample this. Sampling is in BPP. Yep?
Just a quick question. Is that approximation an additive or a multiplicative one?
Let me think. It's a multiplicative approximation. Yep. And note, by the way, that the fact that you can do this sampling in BPP is actually trivial, right? Because what say you want to sample. Say you want to sample this classical problem. What you can do is go yourself and get a bunch of balls, You can put them in this input configuration. You can, you know, randomly move each one as per the stochastic matrix, and you can do the output. The classical process, of course, you can do. I described it. It's a classical process. So of course, sampling is also going to be classically easy. Now, the interesting thing comes with bosons. For bosons, we also have the permanent, just like in the classical case. But now the permanents are going to be of submatrices, not of stochastic matrices, but of unitary matrices. And this might seem like a small restriction, but it makes all the difference. Computing permanents is hard. In fact, for those of you in complexity theory, it's Sharpe complete. I won't go into defining what Sharpe is, but let me just say it's a very difficult complexity class. It's something that would be extremely, extremely surprising if we could solve these problems in polynomial time. And the natural question is, so why is this so different, switching from stochastic to unitary? And I can give some intuition there. In the classical case, we have probabilities. Probabilities add. We had a bunch of different ways that things could happen, a bunch of different ways that the input balls could match with the output balls, okay? And all of those added. Whereas in the unitary case, we're also taking a permanent, but now the things that we're adding are no longer non-negative real numbers, but complex numbers. And because of that, there can be cancellations, right? We can add a bunch of things that push you in this direction, and then a bunch of things that push you in this direction, and get basically zero. We can have cancellations in the way that we saw in the Hong-O-Mandel dip. And because of that, that makes computing the probabilities a lot harder. In some sense, this approximation scheme of Jerm, Sinclair, Vigoda is simply exploiting the fact that we can estimate each of the different ways that the probability that the event could happen, and therefore estimate their sum quite well. Whereas in the case of adding complex numbers, it could be that the final sum is much smaller than each of the component parts, because they mostly canceled. And therefore, tiny errors in approximating each of the component parts are going to lead to a large multiplicative error in the final estimation. Yep?
So is the approximation also hard?
The multiplicative approximation is hard. The additive approximation is easy. The additive approximation is a result of Gurvitz, and also like a result that's quite non-obvious. Yep?
The additive approximation, you just get that from a Chernoff bound, like randomly picked terms and evaluate those, right?
I know, because we have an exponential
have
number
evaluate.
Of outcomes.
Yeah,
the problem with the naive method of estimating of, you know, just run the experiment a million times and see how many times you get the desired outcome is that there's exponentially many possibilities. So generically, you never see your outcome happen. Does that answer your question?
I'm not sure, but
Okay. And finally, this is our main result, okay? That sampling is going to be not in BPP unless the polynomial hierarchy collapses, and I'll say what this means in a second, okay? That this is the motherlode. This is where the difficult stuff comes in, of sampling bosons. So let me also mention before I go, we don't believe, while we believe that doing this is hard, we don't believe it to be universal. We don't believe this to be able to do all of BQP. You can, in fact, simulate this on a regular quantum, on a regular qubit-based quantum computer, but you can't simulate a regular qubit-based quantum computer using it. However, there's a result of Nilaflam and Milburn that if you slightly modify this model to be adaptive, in other words, rather than you do a big matrix, then you measure, you're allowed to do a big matrix, measure some stuff, and then do another matrix on other stuff that depends on the result of the measurement, then this would be universal, in fact. And, you know, then it's easy to say, well, yeah, give it's universal for quantum computers, it's probably not going to be in BPP. So to say what our exact result is that identical boson sampling cannot be done in BPP unless the polynomial hierarchy collapses. So this is a quantum process that we do not believe can be simulated classically under an assumption. And that assumption is unless the polynomial hierarchy collapses. Now, due to time restrictions, I'm not going to define this polynomial hierarchy. I'm just going to say that, you know, it's this hierarchy complexity classes, the bottom two of which are P and NP, and it not collapsing is kind of this generalized version of P not equaling NP. It's an assumption that we very strongly believe. It would be extremely surprising if the polynomial hierarchy collapsed, okay? Therefore, saying that this is true unless the polynomial hierarchy collapses is more or less the best we can do in complexity. Complexity very rarely has unconditional results. Results are of the form that, you know, if this happens, it could only be if this much more surprising thing happened. And we also have an approximate result. This matters because you might say, okay, look, this is not fair. You're asking me to simulate this quantum process classically, but really, you're not allowing me any noise. We know any real quantum process is going to be noisy. The actual quantum boson sampling device is going to have errors in it. But even if we allow the classical device to have errors in it, to have some distance between the distribution it produces and the real one, then we still can show that this cannot happen unless the polynomial hierarchy collapses. Except now we need a few additional conjectures that I'm not going to state here that need to be true for this to be the case. And we have a good reason for believing these conjectures, which we explain in our paper. Okay, questions? Okay, so let me say what the consequences of this result are. The big result is we have a quantum experiment that can't efficiently be classically simulated, right? And this is something that we really want to show exists, right? We really do believe that there are things in the quantum world that are beyond the classical world, even in a computational sense. Not just that they don't exist classically, but that even if you want to figure out what happens classically, you cannot do it in a small running time. And furthermore, that this quantum computer now is solving a hard sampling problem despite a lot of limitations. It's only using bosons that are identical and that are non-interacting. And that it's a one-step experiment. We apply a unitary, then we measure. This is much more of a restricted model than the usual circuit-based model. And that this is now strong evidence of quantum advantage, right? That there is not going to be a classical simulation of this. And you know, I think this is interesting philosophically for the following reason. When we talk about quantum computing, we tend to pin the difficulty of it or the power of it onto two things. Superposition and entanglement, right? But now note here, we're getting some superclassical computational behavior with this very limited form of entanglement and interaction, which suggests that maybe entanglement is not as crucial as we thought. And by noting that the boson model and the classical particle model were really the same, the big difference is that while they're both governed by permanence, we're allowed to have complex values in the boson case, but only non-negative real values in the classical case. And that's where the real difference lies, that in the quantum case, we can have phases that cancel. In some sense, the ability of unitary matrices to have negative and complex entries, unlike probabilities, is what seems to be at the heart of this quantum advantage. Okay? And you can think of this as kind of in the same vein as the evidence that Shor's factoring algorithm gave, right? Peter Shor gave an algorithm to factor a product of two primes into those primes, a problem that we believe to be classically hard, on a quantum computer. But what the significance of this is not just as a specific algorithm that breaks certain cryptographic tasks. This is as evidence that we have a problem factoring that we believe is hard for classical computers. However, that we now know we can do on quantum computers, therefore demonstrating a gap between quantum and classical. But I want to emphasize the difference between our approach and Shor's approach. Okay? Shor's factoring algorithm is very orchestrated behavior, right? There's this very complicated quantum circuit that does this computation that you want, to factor two numbers. But it's very specific. It's very man-made, right? We are making these particles undergo this exact behavior. And implementing it is actually difficult. The most that we've built is a circuit that has factored 21 into 3 times 7. In contrast, what we show with boson sampling is very different. So if Shor's factoring algorithm was like teaching a monkey to play chess and using that to argue that monkeys are intelligent, our approach is instead to observe monkeys in the wild, okay? To show that the things that they do naturally without being trained already show intelligence. In other words, that the generic behavior of identical bosons is already a behavior that you can't simulate efficiently classical. That every time a bunch of photons are generated, you know, the light in this room that's coming to our eye is already doing something super classical all the time. And we think that this has a conceptual advantage, in that it suggests that quantum behavior is hard naturally. That it's not just hard in specific cases. So, well, I don't have much time, so let me skip the pros and cons relative to Shor's algorithm and talk a bit about the experimental prospects about this. Now, I've presented this mostly as a theoretical model, and that's how Scott and I thought of it as. But, you know, thanks to a somewhat fortuitous coincidence, it happens that this exact thing that we're talking about, boson sampling, is quite familiar as linear optics to the experimental community. And therefore, in addition to being conceptually easy, is also a type of thing that very naturally corresponds to experiments that we can do. And these are experiments where the bosons are photons and the unitaries are implemented by a network of half-silvered mirrors. Okay? So we put in a bunch of, we have a bunch of lasers generating identical photons in these different modes, which we, you know, represent spatially by these locations. They bounce around between these mirrors, these beam splitters and phase shifters. And at the end, they come out of a bunch of possible output modes and we count them. So the Hong-O-Mandel dip, which I mentioned before, was a two-mode, two-photon experiment that had been already experimentally well known. This is a scaling up of it to an arbitrary number of modes and an arbitrary number of photons, well, in theory. In practice, oh yes, I should also mention that these beam splitters and phase shifters are universal. That using a bunch of them, even though they only act on two modes coming in and two modes coming out at a time, we can build a network of them to implement any unitary matrix. And quite excitingly, a whole bunch of different groups have already built devices that do this. So there's been four independent implementations, all of which have done it with three photons and a varying number of modes. Now, there are some quite difficult engineering challenges to this, about with the generating photons, passing them through the circuit, keeping them identical, in other words, making sure that they all come out at the same time, because if some come out before others, then you can match, you know, which ones went in first to which ones went out first, and you don't get the superposition, doing counts of photons, and so on. So, three photons is the best that we've been able to do so far. And these experiments have verified the predicted behavior, that they have gotten probabilities that are what you'd predict based on what the permanence says. Now, note that if we could do this with, say, 20 modes or 40 photons, then this would correspond to matrix permanence that would be beyond current computers, would be beyond what can be done on current hardware. Now again, let me emphasize that this device is not computing permanence, right? We do not believe Sharpie contained to be contained in BQP, right? However, each of these outputs is given by a permanent, which is already something that's beyond our ability to compute classically. So if we could scale this up, this would be concrete, physical, experimental evidence that there are computations, actual computations that we can do in the physical world that you cannot do classically. Now, let me emphasize that these are experiments, right? But they're not experiments in the sense of we don't know what the outcome is going to be. We know how phase shifters behave. We know how beam splitters behave. We know, I told you the formalism of identical particles. Unless something goes wrong, it would be extremely surprising if their behavior was something different than what the theory expected. We'd have to revise our understanding of quantum mechanics. The question here is not what the actual behavior is. The question is simply, can we build it, right? Can we overcome the engineering challenges? Are our hands not too clumsy in order to do it? Nevertheless, I should say there are quantum computing skeptics. For instance, one skeptic has predicted that while we've done these experiments with three photons, that we will not get such behavior if we scale up. That scaling up is not an engineering issue, but one of fundamental physics, that there's no way this can work out with 10 photons. So doing this is a very concrete way to debunk those skeptics by actually giving them, by actually demonstrating superclassical computation in the real world. So let me finish with what I think the biggest open problems are for boson sampling. One of them is, okay, we've shown that this quantum device can solve this sampling problem. But in complexity, we like to deal with decision problems. Basically, all complexity classes, well, mostly, are decision complexity classes. You know, is this three-sat formula solvable? Is this graph three-colorable? And so on. So ideally, there would be some yes-no question that could be solved by this boson sampling. Also, it would be nice to solve a useful problem with this boson sampling device. You know, we have this monkey swinging in the forest and it's impressive, but can we actually do something with it? So far, all this is a proof of concept of we know it's hard, but does this correspond to any sort of natural problem? Next, one of the difficulties of this is that even if we build a quantum computer that implements non-interacting boson sampling, is that with Shor's factoring algorithm, it's very concrete how to demonstrate that it works. You know, someone generates two primes and multiplies them, you say what the factors are. And it's easy to verify, you just multiply the numbers. This problem, though, is this randomized problem where you get random output. How do you know that they're not doing it with the right probabilities, given that you can't estimate them yourself? We have some ideas for how to circumvent this, for how to get at least some evidence that your device is simulating boson sampling. But the ideal thing would be some sort of interactive protocol between a prover and a verifier, where the verifier becomes convinced that you're doing the exact computation that you're doing. And finally, the biggest challenge is this engineering challenge, is to actually build one of these scalable linear optics computers on the order of magnitude where it's beyond what can be currently classically done. Okay, thank you, and thank you for inviting me to give this talk. Are there any questions?
Tell us more about the error model for the robust version of this theorem.
Sure. Our error model is solely our errors are errors in the output. So we say if you can get some output distribution that is within epsilon variation distance of the real one, for epsilon being 1 over poly, then you can't classically simulate that. Okay? So it's the most natural one. Our output is a probability distribution. We're going to talk about distance between probability distributions. The natural distance measure is the L1 measure because that tells you how much you can distinguish that. Now, a nice thing that we'd like to show is to show that, for instance, say your mirrors are a bit off. Say your photons are a bit misaligned. To show that experimental errors correspond to that. And that we don't know how to do. As far as we know, there can be small failures, say, in the distinguishability of photons that lead to a cascading large errors in the output distribution. Okay? Any other questions?
So can you say a little bit about this question of what you would actually measure, I mean, if you did this experiment, what you'd actually measure to see if there's a speed up, even though you can't calculate all the actual output probability.
Oh, sorry, I'm not sure what your question is.
So you said you had some evidence that there's something you can actually measure to see that there's a speed up, even though you can't calculate.
Well, not necessarily that there's a speed up, that if someone builds this device that's doing boson sampling, that it's doing boson sampling as opposed to something else. So to say some things you can do, we know that bosons cluster, right? So we can simply compute the degree of clustering and check that that's consistent with bosons as opposed to classical particles. One thing you can do is compute marginal distributions. Even though it's hard to compute the probability of any given outcome, we can say over a constant number of modes, compute what the distribution is over the number of counts of those modes. So what you could do is pick a random subset of modes, calculate those marginals, and compare them to the actual statistics. One thing is in the unitary, like here's a really dumb, naive like way to estimate the permanent. Guess that if you have a permanent with matrix whose entries are big, generally that corresponds to bigger permanents. So if we note that if the outcomes correspond to modes whose rows tend to have big entries in them in the relevant places, then that's more evidence you're doing boson sampling. Okay, so that type of heuristic thing of behavior consistent with boson sampling, but not anything that we can prove cannot be faked by another black box model.
Okay, I mean, is there anything, forgetting proving that cannot be faked,
okay,
is there anything that you don't know how to fake with a classical black box?
I mean, we don't have a good proposal of a classical black box that so far passes these tests. But it would be nice to have one. That way, you know, we have something to work towards, something, you know, to try to draw the line between. Perhaps one natural one, if it helps, is the classical particle case.
Well, okay, but I mean, presumably you want to be smarter than that. I mean, like, so calculating
mm-hmm.
marginals, you can
yep.
calculate them. So the black
yes.
box calculates them and then tries to generate some numbers that are consistent with that marginal. But I,
okay,
I don't know,
right.
I don't know how difficult that is to do. But.
So you could, in fact, do that. Just, you know, the thing that fools the marginal test. I guess for each of these tests that we've proposed, you can just have a classical algorithm that does the test. See what I mean? And then gives
well,
you outputs by
right. so,
rejection
but,
sampling.
But you have a bunch of different tests. So
yep.
you want to have a black box that can generate outputs that pass all those tests without knowing which test is going to be given.
I see. We
so
don't know
that's
that.
That's maybe the question.
We don't know such one. Yep, that would be useful. There was another question?
I just wanted to check that if, like, I give you a 20 by 20 matrix as an efficient algorithm, but like turning that into a map of the split.
Oh, yes, there is. You can, in fact, do it in log depth even more.
On a classical.
Hmm? Yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes, yes. To give a quick summary, there's basically a divide and conquer algorithm that you can do where you split the matrix into four matrices, do each of those, and then recombine them. Any more questions? Okay, well, thank you for listening.